Welcome to Decision Nerds. I'm Paul Richards.
And I'm Joe Wiggins. In this podcast, we analyse decisions, where they can go wrong, and how we can make them more effectively.
We talk with researchers and industry experts about the art and science of understanding human behaviour.
If you want to understand yourself, your team, or board better, there's something here for you. So, Paul, this is the Christmas special episode, and I want to tell a little story about my Christmas experiences so far. As you know, I'm a kind and considerate human being, so I bought all of my team at work a present, which was wrapped nicely, not by me, hence it was wrapped nicely. And as I gave it to them, and they looked at this present, which was a book, obviously a book, but they couldn't tell which book, I realised that they thought I was giving them a copy of my own book. And I reflected on that and realised that they must think I'm a real egotistical arsehole to be dishing out my own book as presents.
And of course, you save the book for distant relatives and other members of the family, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I was assuming that all my team members had read my book cover to cover already, so that's why I wouldn't buy it for them again.
Well, that's good to hear. And for any regular listeners who are just thinking, what's going on? Where's the intro to the Christmas special? When we spoke about this, the reality is that everyone is going to be overdosing on Christmas cracker jokes over the next couple of weeks. And our intros are the metaphorical equivalent of that. So we're going to, as a public service, spare you from them. Well, it'll be interesting to see what books your team have got. Have you given them anything interesting?
There's a few Charlie Munger books in there, a few Rory Sutherland books in there. There's a few books about taking a stoic approach to life, so a broad range. But if anyone is looking for a Christmas gift for a loved one, The Intelligent Fund Investor is, of course, available on all good bookshops websites.
And we'll talk about some of the ways that Amazon might try and make it look attractive a little bit later on. So let's start with the time running up to Christmas. And one of the things that many of us are doing, thinking about the presents that we want to buy, it's clearly a really important time of the year for retailers and restaurants. And for many of them, this is where their behavioral marketing goes into overdrive. It's a really important time to think about behavior because we're actually going to be buying gifts that we sometimes know very little about. And this can make us susceptible to a few things. The first one of those is something called decoy pricing. Let's take an example of some nice Christmas coffee. If we have two coffees, a small one priced at, say, £3 and a larger one at £4.75, we'll probably go for the one that we want. Do we want a big coffee or do we want a small one? But what happens when we stick a medium-priced coffee in at £4.50? Then that may actually nudge us to buying the larger one because it just makes the medium one look such poor value. And we can see this play out in a number of ways around Christmas, or certainly when we're trying to buy an expensive good for our loved one. So if we go into a store that maybe sells handbags or bikes or whatever, there's often an expensive marquee product. But then there's going to be another one that's underneath it that's also pretty outrageously priced, but significantly less than the marquee product. And we can often find ourselves nudged to buy something that's maybe more expensive than it's worth. I think some of the other stuff that we tend to see around this type of year is urgency manipulation. I'm not sure if you've been seeing this, Joe, as you've been buying presents for people, but typically something like 460 views today on a product, stock levels low, a flash sale. All of these things are there to create a sense of urgency and hopefully get us to hit that buy button now.
Certainly everything I've been buying online has been being aggressively bought by other people based on the data being shown to me at the time. Which does give me an itchy trigger finger on the mouse to make sure I don't miss out. But I think the interesting thing around these, in a sense, psychological tricks around pricing and demand is that, to an extent, most people are aware of them. Certainly, in its most basic form. But I still don't think we can deal with them very well. And like with many behavioural issues, foibles, biases that we have, awareness is not a guard at all against them. So reference points or anchoring can be incredibly influential on the decisions we make. And I can feel myself making decisions based on those issues, even though I feel like I'm very well versed in them. I still can't escape how it makes me feel when I encounter those situations. And it takes a lot of effort to pull yourself away from potentially making bad choices because of how things are being presented to you.
One of the things we should always say is start earlier. One of the things that I really miss from my time when I was working full-time in the city is the joy of Christmas Eve afternoon. The worker generally settled down for the day. You could go go home. I used to love walking around the city, particularly when it was snowy, and it would always amaze me every year. You'd see people running around with a huge number of bags. And I should say this is generally men rather than women, who were clearly trying to cram all their shopping into literally the last hour before the stores closed on Christmas Eve, which just creates pressure on us to buy stuff that probably isn't the right thing.
I'm sure incredibly thoughtful presents were being purchased in that situation.
Well, it was obviously good for some of these high-end retailers.
So one key Christmas gift question for me is whether it's better to give people cash or give them gift cards. And I think this is particularly relevant when you're giving presents to children, so nieces and nephews or younger family members, and you don't know exactly what they want. So is it better to give them cash or should you give them a gift card? And viewing it rationally, you'd think, well, give them cash because that gives them the widest range of choice and they can spend it however they like, whereas a gift card restricts their choice. But according to esteemed behavioural scientist Dan Ariely, he talked about gift cards being superior to cash because if you give cash, then people experience emotional guilt from what the other wide range of things that they could be doing with cash. They could be doing something better with the cash, something more meaningful or worthwhile. Whereas if you limit their choice to a particular store or a particular type of product or service, then they have to do that. So narrowing down their range of options into something that you think they will enjoy is likely to result in them feeling far less guilty about using that money in a way that brings them or they think brings them the most happiness. So although from a utility perspective, cash is obviously better than a gift card, in this situation, maybe giving someone a gift card is useful because it stops them feeling the guilt of the wide range of other things they could do with the money. And also maybe in a way it stops the paradox of choice where with cash, you've got so many different options. You could spend the money and you're narrowing that choice down and making it far easier for someone to make a specific decision about what to do with it. So gift cards are behaviorally, I don't think pointless, or they may seem on the face of it to be redundant.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. I'd flip that round from another viewpoint, and I suspect if we could go deep into the data for companies, retailers, I suspect that they love these kind of gift cards, particularly bricks and mortar shops. One, because firstly, there are going to be a percentage of people who don't end up actually redeeming them. They just simply sit in a drawer. In fact, having this conversation now has reminded me, I've got some theatre vouchers from my mother-in-law from about 3 years ago that I haven't used and I probably can't actually redeem now.
Does she listen to the podcast?
No. The second point is that it can promote you spending more money. So if you've got a £50 gift card, do you leave £3 on it or do you buy something that's maybe over and above? There's issues to do with that as well. So I suspect there are some interesting data to be had about what these gift cards add to margins for particularly bricks and mortar retailers. So now let's look at Christmas Day itself. I think it's true that we all want to have a good Christmas. A key question for all of us is, what should define a good Christmas? I think the media landscape is pretty clear about that. It's perfect food, everyone happy, lots of gifts under a huge tree. These things can be good. They might even actually happen for some of us. But the key point is that these things ratchet up the sense of expectation. And from a behavioral perspective, I think the interesting point is that our levels of satisfaction on any given thing are actually a function of our expectation levels and crucially the deviation from that expected value. So I think one of the reasons that people can be disappointed by Christmas is that we see the adverts, we look at what maybe we should have in inverted commas, and when that doesn't arrive, when Uncle Joe gets drunk and angry or the food isn't quite perfect, then that deviation from the expected level of perfection can make us disappointed and all the negative emotions that go with that. And there's a pretty simple behavioral fix to that. And that's just to set more realistic expectations, because if they're beaten, we're likely to come away happier than we might have been otherwise. And this doesn't have to be a depressing affair where we're forecasting a doom-laden Christmas, just one that's grounded in reality. And I think it's really important, not just for the day, but for the aftermath of Christmas. And this is because, you know, something I refer to in the past, the saddest week. The first week in January is the point in time where divorce inquiries peak at lawyers. And it's simply because people get to the end of the Christmas holidays with their family and say, I just can't go through that again. And part of that is really to do with the expectations that they actually set for themselves. I remember, it must have been 25 years ago, hearing a family lawyer talking about this. And she just was really clear, the best way to get through Christmas and not get divorced is actually have low expectations. And that's driven my Christmas strategy ever since. And it's generally been pretty successful.
I have two observations here. One is that drunk and angry Uncle Joe is not a reference to me. That's a different. No. That's a different Joe. The other thing is, Paul is clearly a Scrooge at Christmas with incredibly low expectations in his house, setting up the setting up a menu of crap food and low quality presents.
But I do go out on Christmas morning, or find a small child, a small urchin, and have him get the biggest goose that he can find.
But you are right that the bar for Christmas Day in the Christmas period is set exceptionally high. So there's a lot of downside there in not meeting those expectations. And as you say, happiness is reality minus expectations. So those situations where you are very optimistic about the outcomes do raise the prospect of some disappointment. And again, as you say, the days after Christmas are quite challenging from that perspective, particularly for children, I'd imagine.
So is there anything you particularly like about the Christmas holidays, Joe?
I think the thing I find with Christmas is it's the most relaxing holiday period of the year, not in terms of the amount of things you have to do, but in terms of the stress that you might feel at any other point in the year and the distractions you might have at any other point in the year. And I think this is because it's probably the only part of a calendar year when most people are away from work. So offices are either shut down or they're functioning on a low power mode and not a huge amount is being done. So the expectations around work, if you are in work, are lower, and most people are off work. But when you're on your summer holiday and you're away from the office, you know everyone else is at work. There's things going on that you might need to attend to, and that's why it's really difficult to switch off from work. And while you're checking emails and in contact with people at work, it's really difficult to have proper downtime when it's just you who's on holiday and away from work. Whereas at Christmas, because everyone is, there's just not that same expectation or level of stress about thinking about work all the time, thinking about all the other people, all your colleagues who are working whilst you're away, and what you might need to be involved in or inputting on. So it's a time of year where I think it's generally easier to relax and switch off than any other part of the year.
Yeah, and I would say that anyone who isn't shutting their office, and clearly there are perhaps some industries that find that difficult, going through a live experiment of this happening, being at a firm that decided for the first time to shut properly over the Christmas period, it was a real success. Clients weren't complaining about it. Having a proper 10-day period off was a real benefit for everyone. The staff really appreciated it, came back properly refreshed. I think it built loyalty and energy, which is a terrific double win. So, when you're relaxing, favourite Christmas films from a behavioural perspective?
Well, we chatted about this before recording and we alighted upon the same film, which I'm sure other people will guess as well, which is It's a Wonderful Life, which I actually find quite a stressful, frustrating watch, as much as it is a classic film. I just find it quite harrowing and all the things that go wrong up until the moment on the bridge. But there are a range of behavioural issues in there. So clearly, there's the ability to look back at past decisions and see the consequences of past decisions and other decisions that you might have taken. And there's also this idea that the future, which is ahead of us, could map out in a huge range of different paths, and we are just going down one path. And we tend to look at the past of it as if it's an arrow and was inevitable that would happen, and make predictions about the future, which are similar. But actually, what we're looking at is a quite chaotic, unpredictable world, and the direction we go in could change based on a range of decisions that we make throughout our lives and other people make that affect us. So there are lots of interesting behavioural elements in that film.
I should say a couple of lessons on this. It's been one of my favourite Christmas films forever. trying to get our daughters interested in it, we finally managed to get our eldest at 20 years old to watch it last year. And she was just incredibly upset with us because of the disastrous things that happen in the film. And the real emotional payoff comes right at the very end. And it's at the end, it was like, oh, I'm really glad I watched it. But we had to call her back from the sofa a couple of times. So if you haven't watched it and are trying to get the family around the table to watch it, just be aware of that. But I think the other nice thing about this is that it's a great gift in the sense that the key theme of the film is people not understanding the positive impact that they have on other people. And there was a colleague that I worked with a couple of years ago who just was working incredibly hard, perhaps not seeing the value that she was actually creating, had seen the film before, gave it to her and said, look, this reminds me of you. Just the sense, as you said, of not being able to see all those different paths, how things would have worked out without you. Okay, so the post-Christmas period, do New Year's resolutions get a bad rap?
So I think that they do. Most people I speak to are quite skeptical about New Year's resolutions because they've probably done a lot of them themselves and not stuck with them, and they've seen a lot of other people commit to New Year's resolutions and not stick with them. But I think there's three things to think about here. One is that there are loads of examples of New Year's resolutions, so you don't really know about significant changes that other people make, or at least don't know about them on the scale that they make them on New Year. So there's lots of examples of people failing to stick to their resolutions. So is it a particularly bad time to make resolutions? I don't think so. It's just that we're more aware of people not sticking to those resolutions. The second part is, I think, having a line in the sand to change behavior is a really useful thing to do. It gives you an excuse to make a change to your life. And you may not stick to that, but I think having a point in time where you can say, I want to do X, Y, or Z better or differently, is just quite a helpful thing. Whether it works or not, at least it gives us the impetus to start. I think the other really powerful thing about New Year's resolutions is that more than any other type of change that we might make to our life, it's the one where we're probably going to tell other people about it. So we're going to tell other people that we're going to try and quit smoking, or we're going to try and start running more regularly. And as soon as we make a commitment to something, we're more likely to stick to it. So we make a commitment publicly or make a commitment to a group of people, we're much more likely to stick to that resolution than if we don't commit to other people. And I think that, again, we're just more likely to tell other people at New Year. So net-net, I'd say that, and I have no data to back this up, but I would say that I would be more confident of someone sticking to a resolution they made at New Year than I would be at another random part of the year.
And so what is your New Year's resolution, Joe?
I actually don't have one. I've not yet thought of my New Year's resolution. I will ponder it whilst watching It's a Wonderful Life.
So one of the things that I've reflected on being involved with change management and helping people try and get stuff done is that often when we're thinking about these changes, whether it's a New Year's resolution or something that we want to change within the business, often we can set pretty aspirational targets. I'm going to lose 5 stone this year. I'm going to run a marathon, etc. And those things are no doubt helpful, simply because that aspiration can give us an emotional kick. We can think about that end result. The problem is that often we set targets that are actually really, really difficult. And when we do that, we can often find that we stumble along the way. I've certainly found for myself, and certainly working in certain scenarios, actually focusing on a couple of things. Firstly, having smaller, more achievable targets, you can get a lot of impetus from that when you actually succeed. The second thing is that often we think about the end state that we actually want to get to, whereas I think it can actually be far more valuable to actually think about the process that's going to get you there. So rather than saying, hey, I want to lose 3 stone, we'd probably be far better off to saying, I'm actually going to make it to the gym 3 times a week. Actually focusing on that process rather than the outcome, I think for most people, most of the time, is more likely to get us where we want to be.
Absolutely. Process over outcomes is a wonderful rule for life.
Fantastic. So any last behavioral lessons for a good Christmas?
Can I do am I allowed to do a slightly Grinch, Christmas Grinch one to finish?
Of course you can.
And this is quite work related. So one of the most annoying things about a time of the year that I really enjoy and like is the preponderance of people making forecasts about how equity markets, how stock markets will perform over the year ahead. So making forecasts for what's going to happen in markets in 2024, which I find totally infuriating because it's clearly a totally pointless endeavor. So what you're trying to do, if you boil it down to the fundamentals of what we're trying to do, you're saying I can predict what events will matter to stock markets in the year ahead, and that will include events that I'm not even thinking about that will affect stock markets. So I can predict, in essence, known unknowns, events that I'm aware of that I think will affect markets. I can predict unknown unknowns, so things I'm not even thinking about that will affect markets. And I can also predict how market participants, other investors, will react to those. And I can come up with a number for what equity markets will be come the end of the next 12 months. And it's just ridiculous. Clearly, no one can do that. And if you did do it, your confidence intervals around it would be so wide as to render the forecast totally pointless. And in part, it's harmless fun. But I don't think it's that harmless because it just encourages and perpetuates this idea that markets can be predicted and investors should be making short-term predictions about something that just is inherently unforecastable over short-run horizons. But everyone keeps doing it anyway. So it's just one of those frustrating things that I dislike at the end of the year. But I like being able to moan about it every year.
So listeners, as you are enjoying your Christmas lunch this year, just think about me forecasting doom for the Christmas pudding and Joe ranting to the rest of his family about the pointlessness of forecasts. And hopefully that will make your Christmas day seem a little bit lighter and more fun.